This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Today on the Wisdom Podcast, we'll have David Loy joining us, and he's going to talk about his lineage of Zen Buddhism, the teachers in that lineage that he met, and also what that lineage represents. David is at the forefront of applying Buddhist wisdom to contemporary issues, so he talks about the institutionalized ignorance, greed, and stinginess that we see in the world today. David has recently published a new book with wisdom. It's called A New Buddhist Path. We'll be discussing all these things and more on the Wisdom Podcast. Maybe we'd start with just a little bit of your Buddhist background. Mm. So I know you've studied with Yamada Cohen.
That's
early
right.
on.
That's
and,
right.
And Robert Aiken.
Mm-hmm. In Hawaii.
In Hawaii. Yeah. So how was that?
Well, it's a bit of an interesting story. I used to hang out with a friend in Waikiki, and we used to sort of read spiritual books and fantasize about enlightenment. And one day he announced that he'd learned there was a Zen center near the university. So we went there and sat one evening, 2 hours, and that was about the extent of my sitting experience. But at the end of that, over tea, we were informed that there was going to be a session starting in the weekend with a visiting Japanese Zen master. And my friend and I looked at each other and we said, cool, can we come? The problem was we had no idea what a session was. I think I thought that it was, you know, a bit of meditation, sipping tea and talking with the Roshi and that kind of thing. And it was 7 days of hell. But also in retrospect, it was wonderful. It was very difficult, but afterwards I was hooked.
So you were straight into 7 days.
7 day session, wow. 7 full days. And it was tough because I didn't really have enough background to have any perspective on what was happening, facing the wall and all those thoughts bouncing off. But afterwards, it just seemed like the right path to me. So that's how I got hooked.
Do you have a like specific memory of a time during that retreat that was impressed upon you, or something the teacher said, or is it just that, wow, that was 7 days, I didn't expect that?
Well, what I remember was at the end of the 6th day, I had decided that I was going crazy, and if I didn't feel better afterwards, I was going to go out and kill myself.
Wow.
And after it finished, my friend and I were about to leave through the kitchen door, and somebody caught us, and they said, well, wait a minute, we're going to have a party. Don't go away. And the party was wonderful, and all that stress dissipated.
Yeah.
And actually, later that evening, something happened that really sort of showed me that it was the right path. I don't know if you call it some tiny opening, but it did make a difference in terms of what I wanted to do. So after that, I kept coming to every session. I eventually lived Robert Aiken, who was the person actually running Kokoan. Mm-hmm. He invited me to live in the Maui Zendo, which I did for a couple years, and he was also the one who suggested I go back to university. I had a BA in philosophy, but afterwards I kind of dropped out, and these were my hippie years in Hawaii. I think he thought I might be a translator. He didn't realize how bad I am at languages, so I immediately zoomed back into philosophy, in this case, Asian philosophy. And I was very interested because I wanted to sort of study the tradition more systematically, partly to try to understand what was happening to me in terms of what was going on in the practice and how that was changing me.
The Western philosophy you studied was was that early or modern? What were you doing?
Well, when I was an undergraduate at Carleton College in Minnesota, that included actually a year studying British analytic philosophy at King's College London,
yeah.
My junior year abroad. But the main thing I learned during that year is that I wasn't interested in British analytic.
Okay.
So I finished up much more interested in existentialism, people like Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and especially the later Heidegger.
Yes.
And you know, it's not such a big jump from the later Heidegger to people like D.T. Suzuki, and so that felt quite quite natural.
So that felt quite natural coming into the,
right.
the Zen, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that was also the end of the 60s, and the Vietnam War was a big thing. I became a draft resister, and so I wasn't interested in academia for quite a while. It really did. It was the practice that really revived my interest in Asian and comparative, especially.
Mm-hmm. So you were a couple of years right in there, in the at the monastery. Is that
not
right?
Really a monastery. It was a small, very informal Zen center on Maui, and I think you know Bob Akin, as we called him then. He had a real genius for setting it up in a way that was you know pretty strict rules, but nonetheless in a kind of very, in a way that was very attractive to most of us hippies and made it very comfortable and we felt very welcome. And it really, I mean, my own approach is not terribly interested in a lot of ritual and things like that. And neither was his. So
So that fit well.
That went well. That's right.
It was an easy transition. Into
That's
that.
Right. And then when I went back to university, which he helped to make possible, he was the one who suggested it. And he had used to teach at the university, so he knew the ropes and all that, because I didn't have any money at the time. He actually lent me the money and sort of knew how to apply and so forth, and then I lived at Kokoan Zendo and practiced Zen there even as I was studying in the Asian philosophy department.
While you were in academia, you were there?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Working on my master's. Yeah.
Wow. And so what the transition into academia from, you know, studying with a Zen teacher, how was that? And of course, you'd been studying Western philosophy before that, but it would have been a totally different experience.
Well, I had been reading quite a bit of Buddhist books on my own before I even went back into that. So it didn't feel like a difficult transition. Okay. I mean, you could say I was a hippie, but I was a pretty intellectual hippie, reading my late Heidegger and whatever.
Oh, of course.
So.
Yeah,
I don't remember that being very tough. Okay. In fact, I remember spending a lot of time hanging out in coffee shops. And sort of.
That sounds like not much has changed. And then through teaching, I guess you're a Zen teacher, but also you're a professor. And
right.
How do you, those two different roles, they come together quite easily? Or?
Well, I think I've been really, really fortunate, yeah. What happened was after Hawaii, I spent some time back in the mainland, and then I was visiting my parents in Singapore, and kind of by accident, if there is such a thing, I ended up teaching in the philosophy department there, and especially Asian philosophy. But we also set up a little Zen center, and Yamada Koen Roshi, my main teacher, he actually visited a couple times to lead Sesshin. And at a certain point, he invited me back to Kamakura to sort of practice more intensively with him. Mm-hmm. It's the koan. We had a koan system. And so I had the academic background, and then I was able to really focus on the practice there for several years and eventually finished the formal koan study and became a Zen teacher.
What does it, so we have a lot of listeners who maybe from different traditions, like Tibetan tradition or Vipassana tradition. Mm-hmm. What does it, explain to them what it's like to walk into a Zen temple and engage in practice. What does that look like?
Well, traditionally in Japan, it would be pretty strict, pretty severe practice. But actually, our tradition is a fairly new one. If you're familiar with the book Three Pillars of Zen, it's talking primarily about that. There was a Soto priest, Harada Roshi, back in the early part of the 20th century who couldn't find a good enough teacher and actually ended up practicing with a Rinzai teacher. And then his main successor, Yasutani, had the same experience. Both of them were priests, but Yamada Roshi, my teacher, was actually a layman, very successful Japanese businessman. And he and his wife actually knocked down a lot of their house to build a zendo. So we actually meditated not in a temple, but in a dojo that was attached to their home.
And that was where?
That was in Kamakura, which is a suburb of Tokyo. Very famous one. It was the capital about 900 years ago. It's famous for the big bronze Buddha that's outside, which is not so far from where we practiced, actually.
How interesting, because, you know, these days as Buddhism's coming to America and other countries, people are gathering in people's lounge rooms to meditate and hear Dharma. And here's a case in Japan, Yamada Koen making space in his house.
That's right.
For people to come and practice.
That's right.
And and there's a new flavor to this practice, is that right? Or it's not as strict and formal as Zen had been in Japan, is that?
And still is. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the official monasteries, right. What's interesting about Sambo Kyodan, actually now it's called Sambo Zen, is that as far as Japanese are concerned, there aren't that many people who practice. It's more, well, maybe that's changing now, but certainly in my time, most of the students there were international. Mm-hmm. Many of them from Europe, from Philippines, and some from America. And they were there. Well, Yamada Roshi was very open to people. In fact, a number of them were Christian, and that wasn't a problem for him. Mm-hmm. His basic idea was, you know, put your beliefs sort of on a shelf. Just do what I tell you, and whether you're Christian or Buddhist or whatever, he wasn't bothered about that.
So it's quite progressive in the.
Yes, very much so. And he also spoke quite a bit of English, which helped for a lot of us too.
Yes, that's very helpful. Okay. Wonderful. And so then I guess I'm interested in how your practice has evolved since those days. So what does meditation mean to you now? What does that look like for you? And how do you express that? And how do you teach it?
Well, I mean, in terms of my own practice, it's not nearly as intensive in terms of, you know, the amount of time that I sit. I mean, I usually sit in the morning. That would be my primary time to do so. Very occasionally in the evening, but often with a lot of travels, it doesn't always work out. Yeah. The Sambo Zen tradition, and I should add that, you know, there's a number of other teachers around. I mean, for example, Ben Abito in Dallas, and Joan Reek and Henry Shukman in New Mexico. There's still lots of traditional type Zen meditation, you know, facing the wall.
Yes.
In our tradition, as I said, we work on koans. Mm-hmm. But so I would sense that the main difference is that a lot of the ritual side of it is tends to be minimized. But in terms of the actual meditation, my sense is that it's much the same as it would be in a Zen monastery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You asked about my own experience of teaching. Actually, that's been quite limited because of the way my sort of life trajectory has worked out. Almost all of the people, the international students who came to practice with Yamada Roshi, when they became qualified as teachers, they went back to their home countries and set up centers or continued teaching as if they had been doing some before. In my case, my wife and I both ended up teaching in Japanese universities. And so living Kamakura, there was no need to set up as another Zen teacher, right? And even then, when I came back, beginning of 2006, we moved back to the U.S. I had a teaching position at Xavier University. Mm-hmm. And later moving to Boulder, Colorado. And so I haven't been in a single place, and I haven't really wanted to sort of, you know, create a Zen center of my own.
Yes.
And even now, living in or just outside of Boulder, where there's so much Dharma of all sorts, including Zen, I don't know that they need another Zen teacher. So my teaching is primarily going around, you know, giving workshops, retreats, various places when I'm invited. Sometimes in universities, there'll be a lecture or a symposium, and often it's a Zen center or a Vipassana center where, you know, they'll ask me to come give a workshop on some particular issue. Mm-hmm. So I do have a few private students, a couple in person, a couple that I work with by Skype, but I haven't really focused on that aspect of teaching so much, and a lot of energy into writing.
Yes. Yeah. What's the role of, in your mind, what's the role of the teacher in your tradition?
Well, I mean, people can meditate, mm-hmm. and sort of make a lot of progress, however you want to define by oneself. But there's a lot of focus in our tradition on Kensho.
Kensho.
Yeah, and that's the word often translated as enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not sure I like that word so much. Awakening, I think, is better, but we have to be a little careful because Kenshos are often not all that big and dramatic. Mm-hmm. It can be a little opening, a little insight. Mm-hmm. There can be a great variety of clarity and depth, mm-hmm. in what happens. But there is a lot of focus on that practice. And usually for that to happen, it is important to work pretty closely with a particular Zen teacher who understands the process, and sort of, because there's lots of ways you can get lost and a bit confused, and it's really valuable to have somebody there who sort of knows what's going on and knows
a guide. Stuff, yeah.
There you go. Yeah,
very nice. And so I think some of these topics like teacher and meditation practice are very much the things that people are interested in as Buddhism comes into the West and as it changes and less ritual or more of this or more of that. And you've made the comment that when Buddhism encounters a new culture, that both are changed. And I think that's very insightful to see both sides of the coins.
Right.
And there's an interplay there.
For sure.
They work. It's working. There's something going both ways.
Right.
And so I was hoping you could talk to a little about both sides. Maybe firstly, how you see that Buddhism has changed or might change as it encounters mm-hmm. the modern world.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's still early days, isn't it?
Yes.
So we can talk about a kind of progress report of mm-hmm. what's happening now, but it's hard to anticipate in some ways. What I see happening so far, one might expect that the main interaction might be, say, with Christianity or the Judeo-Christian tradition in general. And certainly there's a lot going on there. I mean, there's even a whole society of Buddhist Christians studies. There's a journal and all that. But I don't think that's where the main action is. Probably the most interesting interaction so far is with Western psychology, including Western psychotherapy. A lot of Western-trained therapists are Buddhist practitioners. In fact, some of them are actually qualified as Buddhist teachers as well. And so there's interesting give and take there. What I find especially helpful is that the Buddhist tradition hasn't always been so sophisticated in terms of its understanding of where things go wrong. What I mean by that is that I think the psychotherapeutic Western tradition it is quite sophisticated in certain ways in terms of understanding things like repression, mm-hmm. Projection, transference, things like that, and also what's sometimes called spiritual bypassing. I mean, back in the day when I started Zen, many of us had the idea that all that was needed was just to meditate mm-hmm. hard and long and mm-hmm. one would be transformed and psychological issues would all be taken care of. And it's not so simple. For some people, maybe a lot of people, combining the Zazen meditation
yes.
with some types of therapy can be very beneficial.
So spiritual bypassing is ignoring other aspects of psychological development? Is that...
So spiritual bypassing is a very interesting term that refers to how actually it's not simply that meditation might not help deal with some of these issues, but in certain ways it can be used to make things worse.
Yeah.
For example, I'm thinking of Jack Engler, who I quote in the new book, where he says, teachings on no self can be used to rationalize a kind of lack of integration or cohesive self. Mm-hmm. I think it was Engler who originally made the point that you have to have a healthy sense of self in order to lose it.
Yes.
And he says, teachings on non-attachment can rationalize an inability to form relationships. Mm-hmm. Enlightenment can be used as some type of idealized, grandiose self, right? Mm-hmm. And likewise, devotion to a teacher can allow one to feel special in mirroring the idealized other, you see, or and also sort of masking one's own feelings of inferiority. So the process is subtle in certain ways, and when some of those issues come up, it can be very happy. It can be very helpful to combine the meditation practice with certain types of psychotherapy.
Yes, and so when you reduce the problem to one solution, it can actually become part of the problem, in
exactly.
a sense.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there an idea that you can evolve on a spiritual level separate to other psychological factors? So some teachers could be very, in a way, whatever this means, spiritually advanced,
mm-hmm.
but ethically immature. Or
I can think of several well-known examples, unfortunately.
Yeah, and yeah, that might yeah. be a case of spiritual bypassing.
Right.
In a way.
That's right. I mean, I think we've had a kind of naive view about enlightenment or awakening, and it's a lot more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that one can open up and have, you know, certain types of experiences, but that doesn't necessarily resolve, you know, deep-rooted, maybe self-centered, even narcissistic habitual tendencies.
Mm-hmm. So Kensho may not be enough. Is that the message? Or is Kensho enough? Awakening experiences.
Right. Well, is anything enough? I'm thinking of the Japanese saying, even the Buddha's only halfway there.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So my teacher, Yamada Roshi, had a nice analogy to sort of point to that. He said how when we meditate, it's as if the teacher is telling us to polish a wall,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's weird. Polish a wall? You know, why? Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the teacher tells us to do it, and so we do it. But Kensho, or the opening, or the first glimpse, is realizing that, hey, it's not a wall because you can see through it. It's actually a pane of glass
mm-hmm.
that's been so covered with dust and paint and whatever, mud. Mm-hmm. And so the first opening or awakening is realizing that, but nonetheless, it's usually a pretty small, you can't see very clearly what's on the other side. So it's really, really important to sort of keep polishing that,
yeah.
that window pane until it's completely clean. And then what the Japanese call daigotete, deep enlightenment or complete
yeah.
enlightenment, is smashing that window pane so that there's nothing anymore between you and what's on the other side. So it's a more non-dual experience. But even that's not the end of the path. The more we practice, the more it's not just about having experiences, it's about integrating whatever one is realizing into how one actually lives one daily life. And that's a practice that goes on forever.
And I think that talks to another thing you've spoken about, is that it's not enough to just deconstruct the self.
Right.
One must also reconstruct the self. And do you want to talk to a little bit about that idea?
Right. Now, that way of putting it, which is my way of putting it,
yes.
can be a little misleading. They actually go on at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the deconstruction is basically what we're doing when we're meditating.
Mm-hmm.
So if the sense of separate self, which for Buddhism, you know, this sense of separation is dukkha, it's suffering, it's always uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I say, it's haunted by a sense of lack,
yes.
the feeling that something
yes.
is wrong with me, right? So if it's because that sense of self is actually a construct, it's composed of mostly habitual ways of thinking, feeling, acting, reacting, remembering, planning, intending. It's the way these processes work together that create the sense of a separate self inside that's separate from the rest of the world outside. So when we're meditating, what are we doing? Well, thoughts come into our mind, but we're not acting, we're not responding to them. So because of that, we're sort of letting them go. And in that sense, you could say that the sense of self is being deconstructed by letting go of those habitual ways of thinking, ways of acting. And then, well, of course, Dogen talks about it as forgetting the self. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there were a real self, we wouldn't be able to get rid of it. But the whole point is we have this illusion of separation. Yeah. And in the process of the meditation, we're able to let go of that. Mm-hmm. That's the deconstruction side. The reconstruction, I think, is actually pointing to what I suspect is the real meaning of the karma teaching. Mm-hmm. Because what the Buddha emphasized, and this was really an important part of his spiritual revolution, is that what creates karma isn't just what you do, it's your motivations, it's your intentions. And I think we often miss the point because we get focused on the results. We're thinking, you know, either what I'm experiencing now, I must have done something bad in my past lifetime to deserve it. Or else we're thinking, oh, I've got to behave in a certain way now if I want to get certain results in the future. I think what the Buddha was getting at is something quite different. I think he was saying, if you want to transform how you experience the world right here and now, mm-hmm. there's a simple, not necessarily easy, but simple way to do that. Transform your motivations, mm-hmm. right? If I'm motivated by what Buddhism calls the three fires or the three poisons, mm-hmm. greed, ill will, delusion, then I'm going to be relating to you in a certain way. In a way that aggravates the sense of separation, right? The tendency will be to manipulate you or to manipulate my circumstances. But if I can transform those motivations so that I'm motivated not by greed, but by generosity, not by ill will, but loving kindness, mm-hmm. not by the delusion of separation, but the realization that we're not separate, that my well-being is not really separate from your well-being, then I'm actually going to experience the world in a different way. And people will experience me differently and tend to respond to me differently. And that's huge. And unfortunately, the way karma people, the way people often think about it, they miss this essential point. So basically, I think what the Buddha is saying is there's something very empowering that we get a handle on by simply transforming our motivations now. Don't worry about the results. Those will take care of themselves, you see. But make sure, work on your motivations. And that's the reconstruction side of it.
And those in that idea of intention, this is very nice, by the way. I really, that's a nice interpretation of karma and relating karma to an experience, way of experiencing the world. And, you know, though intention and motivation can be very subtle as well. So that can happen on a more, like, almost experiential level. And I know Vasubandhu, who's you may know of the Sanskrit scholar, he defines karma as intention.
Right.
And he defines intention as the movement of the mind.
Right, right.
And then relates that to, well, that arises as feeling.
Right.
And I think, like, what you say is very true. And the way we experience the world is not just perceptual but feeling as well. When you see a friend or a stranger or an enemy,
right.
it's very much it's your feeling as part of that experience.
Right.
And so I think intention and motivation must be tied up in it.
For sure. But it's not just something going on in the mind. Mm-hmm. It's the intentions, it's intentional action.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not enough just to cultivate a certain frame of mind. How does that actually reflect it in what we do day by day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's intention followed by action,
which
is basically Vasubandhu's definition as well.
Right.
So in speech and physical action, right?
Right. You know, there's a famous anonymous verse that summarizes this very well, I think. It's not Buddhist. I don't know where it came from, but there's four lines, right? Mm-hmm. Sow a thought, sow in the sense of planting, you know, throwing seeds out. Sow a thought, reap a deed.
Mm.
Sow a deed, and reap a habit. Mm. Sow a habit, and reap a character. Mm-hmm. Sow a character, and reap a destiny.
Very nice.
That's powerful. I mean, it's not always so simple, is it? But
It's nice to have that, you know, that's those steps.
Exactly.
And I guess the question becomes, how do I change my intention from greed to generosity?
Right.
How do we go about doing that work?
Well, I mean, it's rarely the case that our motivations are completely pure or completely dark, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that there's a kind of a mixture. And it's very clear in the earliest teachings, the Buddha is saying, you know, become more aware of the mind and minimize the negative tendencies and build on the positive ones. And this is why it ties so well together, this process, with the meditation. Mm-hmm. Because when we're meditating, we're becoming a lot more aware of how the mind works. Mm-hmm. and less deceived by it. So
knowledge of the mind, and then that will help with intentions.
We see how our thought processes work. Mm-hmm. That's right. And yes. And how they, you know, and how they have this reference back to I, me, mine, my own well-being, looking out for number one, and we get a more of a handle on the thinking. Right? Mm-hmm. Like my favorite bumper sticker says, "Don't believe everything you think," and yes. And basically, you know, learning to meditate is learning to do that. Yeah,
very nice, very nice. I think that's great. I think
too much.
No, I think that's perfect. There's magic, actually. That was very nice, very deep, very fast.
Should I say in a little bit, just a word or two about the new book?
Please. Yeah.
So the new book, A New Buddhist Path, is basically concerned with what all my books are concerned about. It's this, what I call conversation. Mm-hmm. Between traditional Asian Buddhism and modernity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough to reduce one to the other. In other words, it's not simply a matter of importing the Asian forms of Buddhism into America and simply being comfortable with that. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, Buddhism originated as an Iron Age tradition, and all of its Asian forms are pre-modern. We really need to interrogate that. Mm-hmm. But likewise, I don't think it's adequate just to sort of pick and choose and ask, what is it in Buddhism that fits in with our modern understanding? I think each needs to interrogate the other. Mm-hmm. We need to adopt the position of Buddhist understanding to look at the modern world, and we also need to take a modern stance, and it's that conversation, that dialogue between them, that I find so fertile. So the new book is an attempt to do that in a couple different ways. One of the things it does is look at this whole question of what is awakening, because in certain parts of the Buddhist tradition, it seems to be about transcending this world, you know, not being reborn. Mm-hmm. This world is inherently the world of suffering and craving, and so the idea isn't to change it in any way, it's to escape it. Partly, or largely in response to that, a lot of modern Buddhism, I think, understands the path as simply dealing with your own mind. Mm-hmm. And sort of fitting in better. Sort of, if I understand the problems going on in my own mind, then I'll harmonize better and be able to fulfill my social roles and family obligations better, that sort of thing. I think both of those understandings of awakening are problematical in the sense that one of them rejects this world completely, mm-hmm. just wants to escape it, mm-hmm. and the other one accepts it completely. Yeah. And I think in a way, both of them miss the point that, as I was saying earlier, I think the Buddhist path is about deconstructing and reconstructing our sense of self, or maybe better, deconstructing and reconstructing our relationship with other people and with the world in general. And so we're not trying to escape the world, we're trying to experience it, we're working to experience it and ourselves in a different way. And this also has really important implications for how we understand social issues. Mm-hmm. What I would call institutionalized dukkha, or institutionalized suffering.
Yes.
It's not simply that in the practice I'm working to reconstruct myself, but I think we can see our society has dukkha caused by organizations, yeah. and that too needs to be reconstructed.
And you talk very eloquently about the institutionalization of mental afflictions. So how we've institutionalized ignorance.
Right.
In the education system,
right.
institutionalized greed in the economic systems.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's so powerful.
Sure. So, today I think we face a problems or social problems that the Buddha didn't face, that we not only have much more powerful technologies, we also have much more powerful institutions. And the point of an institution is that it sort of takes on a life of its own. And to say it takes on a life of its own means that it has its own motivations built into it. So, for example, it seems to me that today we've institutionalized greed into our economic system. If greed means you never have enough, well, consumers never consume enough, corporations are never profitable enough, GNP is never big enough. But why is more always better if it can never be enough, you know? Likewise, I think we've institutionalized ill will in our militarism. I mean, we're by far the most militarized society in history if you look at it in terms of the money, the resources that we put into it. And the danger there, of course, if you're going to spend that much money on your military, you've got to keep finding enemies. You've got to keep fighting wars, which we are doing. You know, we're kind of in a permanent sort of war mentality now.
It's such a self-destructive
For sure. War on terror, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of, when will it end? It's already by far the longest war we've ever fought. When will it end? Will we know?
When everyone's enlightened, terror will be gone. There's a misuse
of the word, right?
Well, I think when I think about something like drones, it's like, the interesting thing about the war on terror is that it constantly creates more and more people who hate us.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of self-perpetuating, isn't it?
And the war on terror, its main weapon is terror. If you're looking at drones flying over people's... you're terrorizing.
As somebody put it, terrorism is the war of the poor. War is the terrorism of the rich.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very sad, but true.
Yes. Yeah. And then finally, institutionalized delusion. You mentioned our educational system, you know, which is more and more about not sort of trying to help us understand things, but more a kind of higher form of job training. But in particular, I think we see it with the media. The major media outlets are mega corporations. And their main concern, of course, is not really to educate or inform us, but to find ways to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder. So what that means, of course, is that they're not going to really be raising what I think are the really important questions about the whole direction of our society, about our consumerism. Their whole tendency is to normalize consumerism, right? And that's kind of scary, because we're in a situation now where I think we can see consumerism is a lot of the problem, ecologically, that we never seem to have enough. Yeah. So these are problems that I don't think the Buddha had to face. You know, we have, our society is so much more complex, so much more populated, for one thing, and economically it's just so so huge and so powerful, so much a juggernaut. But if the Buddha is right that the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, are like the main causes of evil or the main causes that create problematic things, and if we've institutionalized them, well, that's quite a challenge. We're in trouble. And, well, it shows us that it's not enough for Buddhist practitioners simply to be preoccupied with their own awakening.
Yes.
We also need to awaken to what's going on socially and institutionally.
And so Buddhism, you mentioned institutions take on a life of their own. And one of the criticisms of you find of Buddhist or Buddhist institutions is they're not socially beneficial, or there's this call to the mountains or call to retreat, and Buddhists aren't engaged. And so what are your thoughts about, you know, a type of engaged Buddhism institutionalized Buddhism forms that help? You know, I know Bhikkhu Bodhi is very much engaged in, you know, helping, solving the problem of hunger. And then he's discovered that actually that's quite closely related to the problems of education in underdeveloped countries. And so he's trying to help in some way there. What's your thoughts about Buddhism and social engagement and institutions and Buddhist institutions?
Well, one thing I'm concerned about, specifically with reference to climate change or the ecological crisis in general, I think we Buddhists have our own personal ways of solving the problem of climate change. Mm-hmm. That when we think about the issue, or when we are confronted with new, usually startling information about how things are getting worse, we become anxious. And as meditators, as practitioners, we know what to do when we become anxious. We sit down, we face the wall, we meditate for an hour, and the anxiety goes away. Mm-hmm. The point being, of course, that that's not really a long-term solution, but the tradition, if it's understood in a certain way, that tends to be our response to a lot of these issues. Yeah, this is, I think, one of the other important ways in which Buddhism is changing now that it comes to the West. I mentioned a bit earlier, psychologically, we have this interaction with Western psychotherapy, but we also have interaction with the whole Western concern for social justice, which comes out of the Abrahamic traditions. You think of the Hebrew prophets, for example. And I think we're in a situation now where we can see how the traditional Western concern for social justice, the idea that we can restructure our societies to make them better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot's been achieved in the last couple hundred years. If you think about democracy and bills of rights and freedom of speech and anti-slavery campaigns, civil rights movements, feminism, in my generation, gay rights, and, yes, you know, transgender. I mean, a lot has been achieved, mm-hmm, but we can also see the resistance. In some ways, we seem to be moving in the other direction now with the growing gap between rich and poor. And I think that is what brings us to what Buddhism has to offer, because we could have the most perfect possible society and economy, whatever that means, but if the people within that society, if they're still motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, is that society going to work well? Or isn't it going to be the case that people will be trying to subvert it and take advantage of it, which I think is happening? Yeah. So then we look at the Buddhist side, which, I mean, what's wonderful about the way the Buddhist tradition developed, of course, is that it's created what must be the world's greatest collection of contemplative practices that, you know, we can do to transform ourselves. But in order to survive historically in non-democratic societies in Asia, Buddhism didn't develop the social dimension. It hasn't really been able to look very much at what I would call social or institutionalized dukkha. Mm-hmm. But now that it comes to the West or the modern world, we can see we have these two ideals, or even these two projects, and how they really need each other. Mm. How the Western concern for social transformation,
yes,
and the traditional Asian or Buddhist concern for personal transformation, individual transformation, how well they work together and how they really need each other. So that's also one of the main themes in the new book. The interaction between
those
two
very right. personal, and the other one's very almost global, right, or institutionalized stuff.
That's right. And what's also interesting, if that's the word to use, is that this is happening right now in our generation, mm-hmm, in our age, when we have big problems. And we need both, I think. We need the best of both. I mean, the problems we face today, quite interestingly, both economically and ecologically, they are the problems that modernity has created, right?
Yes.
So
that's why the Buddha wasn't dealing with the, you know, climate change,
right,
or the disparity.
So we need to ask, well, if modernity has created these problems, there may be some value in a non-Western,
yeah,
non-modernist tradition that has a different way of thinking, you know?
Yeah.
And just as the Abrahamic emphasized the kind of moral good versus evil, so Buddhism gives us insight into these structures of delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Buddhism has something very, very powerful to offer here as well.
So that's David Loy, a lucid thinker, I'm sure you'll agree, and one of the major figures in the integration of Buddhism into the modern world. David has written and contributed to numerous books, including Money, Sex, War, Karma, A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency, and A New Buddhist Path. So check those out if you want to hear more from David. You can also check him out at davidloy.org. That's all for this week. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Wisdom Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting app of choice. And if you're on iTunes, please give us a rating. Keep an eye out for the next episode where I'll be interviewing Jamyang Rinchen. Jamyang Rinchen is His Holiness the Dalai Lama's Chinese translator. He's got a fascinating job, and he takes us behind the scenes of what it's like to travel and translate for His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
So I want to check what he's doing.
Does His Holiness watch movies on the plane? This is what you want to check?
I never. Since 1997 until 2008, I often get chance to travel with him. If he sees something on TV, always news.
News, yeah.
Never,
if he watches
ever
the TV,
movies.
It's always news, never movies.
Never dramas, never movies. I didn't see it anyway.